Follow us on Twitter at Louis Gang Entertainment, on YouTube and Instagram at Louis Gang. It will mean so much to the whole team.
For most, the 1980s is a fun, nostalgic era, filled with mullets, shoulder pads, and Top Gun. But there's a darker side to the decade that flaunts a much more sinister side of humanity. As club drugs hit the scene, the number of violent crimes being committed seemed to skyrocket to new and terrifying heights, and the rise of serial killers made many fearful for their lives. Richard Ramirez and Jeffrey Dahmer are just two of the decade's most infamous murderers, but the 80s era is home to many more, and many other ferocious attacks, with an abundance of cases remaining, to this day, unsolved. In today's video, we're focusing on just three of these unsolved murder cases from the 1980s. Dorothy Jane Scott. Dorothy Jane Scott was born April 23rd, 1948, and at the time of her disappearance was a single mother living in Stanton, California with her aunt and her four-year-old son. Working as a secretary for two jointly owned local Anaheim stores, Dorothy was said to have been a woman who enjoyed staying at home with her son rather than going out and mixing with others. She was a devout Christian, stayed clear of alcohol and drugs, and while she dabbled in the dating scene, she had no steady boyfriend. Months before Dorothy's disappearance, she received chilling, anonymous phone calls from a man who would alternate between declaring his love for her and threatening to kill her. The unidentified male claimed he'd been stalking her, and even provided Dorothy with accurate details of her daily life to prove it. To further reinforce this, he once called Dorothy and told her to go outside, where she found a single dead rose on the windshield of her car. According to her mother, Dorothy recognized the voice, but couldn't quite put her finger on who it was, as she struggled to remember the name of the man. Most frightening of all, the man once told Dorothy he'd cut her up into bits so no one would ever find her. Fearing for her life, Dorothy began to take karate lessons a week before her disappearance, and she even considered buying a handgun, something she didn't seem to go through with for fear that her son would get a hold of it and injure himself. May 28th, 1980 was not a particularly unusual day. Around 9 p.m, Dorothy attended an employee meeting at her workplace and noticed that one of her colleagues looked ill and had an unusual red mark on his arm. She insisted on taking him to the hospital, accompanied by another female employee. Dorothy stopped in at her parents' home to check on her son and tell them about the situation before she and her colleagues arrived at the emergency room at UC Irvine Medical Center. Doctors and nurses worked quickly to find that Dorothy's colleague had been bitten by a black widow spider, and he was treated promptly, being discharged with medication at 11 p.m. The entire time that the sick colleague was being treated, neither Dorothy nor her female colleague left the waiting room. Ever thoughtful, Dorothy decided to go and fetch her car from its spot in the parking lot and bring it to the exit so that her recovering colleague wouldn't have to exert much energy. As she went off, her colleagues waited. However, after some time, they saw she still hadn't turned up, and so they stepped outside into the parking lot to see what was going on. Suddenly, Dorothy's car came speeding at them, the headlights blinding them, and the car sped past and took a sharp right out of the lot. Thinking something had happened to Dorothy's son, the pair waited for her to return, but she never would. After several hours of silence, Dorothy's parents were contacted. They confirmed that she hadn't returned home and went on to call the authorities. At 4:30 a.m. on May 29th, Dorothy's car, a white 1973 Toyota station wagon, was found burning in an alley 10 miles away from the hospital. Her body was nowhere to be found. About a week after their daughter had vanished, Dorothy's parents began to receive strange and unsettling calls from an unidentified male, who said, "I've got her," and hung up. He called almost every Wednesday afternoon when Dorothy's mother was home alone and would tell her that he had Dorothy or that he had killed her. The phone calls were always brief, to the point that the authorities couldn't trace them. In April 1984, the man called in the evening. This seemed to be a mistake, as, once Dorothy's father answered, the man stopped calling for 4 months. In June of 1980, the Orange County Register newspaper reported on the case of Dorothy and was later in the day contacted by an unknown man, who said, "I killed her. I killed Dorothy Scott. She was my love. I caught her cheating with another man. She denied having anyone else. I killed her." The caller also knew that her colleague had suffered from a spider bite on May 28th, and they knew that that day, Dorothy had changed from a black scarf to a red scarf, after the employee meeting. Neither of these details had been made public at that time. The unknown man also claimed that Dorothy had called him that night, but her colleagues disputed this by saying she was never out of their sight. It took 4 years following her disappearance for Dorothy's body to surface. On August 6, 1984, a construction worker discovered her skeletal, partially charred remains about 30 feet from the Santa Ana Canyon Road. Curiously, her body was found alongside that of a dog. Authorities speculated that the charring had come from a bushfire in 1982. Dorothy's turquoise ring was found, along with her watch, which had stopped at 12:30 a.m. May 29th, about an hour after her car was last seen. Roughly a week later, the body was conclusively identified as Dorothy's through dental records, but no cause of death could be determined. In recent years, a suspect has emerged by the name of Mike Butler, whose sister was a colleague of Dorothy's before she disappeared. However, any leads from this are slow to surface. Dorothy's parents, who raised her child after she went missing, both died without seeing justice be served to their daughter's killer. As of 2020, the case of Dorothy Jane Scott is still unsolved. Peggy Hetrick. An attractive 37-year-old redhead, Peggy Hetrick was the victim of an unsettling and gruesome murder in Fort Collins, Colorado, with a botched investigation that led to the unjust conviction of a man who'd been just 15 at the time of the crime. About 9 p.m. on February 10th, 1987, Peggy left her workplace at Foothills Mall and began her journey home. As she didn't have a car and lived nearby, it was normal for her to walk wherever she needed to go. Having given the keys of her apartment to a temporary roommate, Peggy ended up returning home to find herself locked out. Her roommate was passed out in the apartment after drinking and couldn't unlock the door for her, so Peggy left and went to a nearby bar, the Laughing Dog Saloon. She attempted to wake up her roommate by repeatedly calling the apartment, but she had no luck as it didn't seem to stir them. She reportedly talked angrily about being locked out. After spending about 15 minutes in a second bar, the Prime Minister, it's speculated that Peggy went to her ex-boyfriend's house nearby, as witnesses report seeing a woman matching her description loitering in the parking lot while smoking. The same brand of cigarettes found here was the brand found on Peggy's body the next day. Also in her possession at the time of her discovery was a handwritten note that read, "Matt, I've been locked out of my apartment. Don't get grumpy if I come knocking around 2. Peggy managed to get back into her home around 12 a.m., where she got changed and then left again. A neighbor reported seeing her banging on the door, and her roommate told police that this time frame was correct. Around 12:30 a.m., she returned to the Prime Minister and bumped into her ex. As he was meeting another woman, Matt said the two had a friendly conversation and then parted ways when his date showed up. Dawn, the woman Matt was with, says that he kept looking over at Peggy and that she spoke to a group of men all night. After this, it is unclear how exactly the night ended. According to Matt, he offered Peggy a lift home, but she refused and they argued. He also said, while she first accepted, he went to the bathroom and he came back to find her giving him a dirty look before she left without him. He and Dawn agree that Peggy left around 1 to 1:30 a.m., but they weren't certain that she left alone. Dawn went back to Matt's and stayed till around 3 a.m. The next morning, around 7 a.m., a cyclist discovered what he at first thought was simply a mannequin in a field. However, as he got closer, he saw the blood trail and the pool around the body and realized this was a human being. Peggy's end had been extremely violent. Her clothing had been pushed aside and she had been brutally, sexually mutilated, to the point where the coroner said the work was precise and skilled and would require a level of expertise. Her cause of death was noted as being a stab wound to the upper left back, which likely occurred earlier that morning, with her time of death being placed between 6:30 p.m. and 4:30 a.m. Since we know Peggy was alive at least at 1:30 a.m, the window of opportunity is narrowed significantly. Previously that morning, someone else had actually seen Peggy's body from a distance. 15-year-old Timothy Masters was on his way to school when he noticed it, but quickly dismissed it as a mannequin which had been placed there for a prank. When canvassing, policemen showed up at the door of Masters' home. Timothy's father mentioned to them that his son had gone a different route than normal that morning, and so he was pulled out of his class at school. The skewed investigation was led by Detective Jim Broderick, who had tunnel vision from the get-go. He horned in on Timothy Masters from the start, despite the fact that no physical evidence linked him to the crime. Two hairs found on Peggy's body and the prints on her purse did not match Timothy. On February 12th, Timmy's home was searched, as was his school locker. Authorities found 2,200 pages of writings and violent artwork in his room, school locker, and backpack, which depicted images of murder and assault. They also uncovered a knife collection, pornography, and a local newspaper with an account of the body's discovery in it. Again, no real physical evidence tied Timothy to Peggy's murder, as none of her DNA was on any of his clothing or any of his other belongings. There wasn't any in his room, either. While Timothy was questioned with his father's permission, he wasn't questioned with an adult present, despite the fact that he was a minor. Police reportedly told him that they knew he'd committed the crime, but Timothy protested his innocence during the entire interrogation. He took a lie detector test, but its results were inconclusive. With no new leads, investigators seemed desperate. They planted an article containing false information in the local newspaper, attempting to provoke an incriminating reaction from Timothy. But even to the authorities surveying him closely, he had no such reaction. Attempting to put the past behind him, Timothy went on with his life, eventually serving time in the Navy. However, this would not dilute the police's interest in him. In 1992, a classmate told authorities that Timmy had told his friends details of the mutilations to Peggy's body. Timothy said that he had learned them from a friend in art class who had been part of the Explorer Scouts who helped the police search the crime scene, where he was told about the mutilations. Police found that Timothy's story checked out. 5 years later, Jim Broderick, the lead investigator on the case, contacted Dr. J. Reed Malloy, a forensic psychologist from California, and had him analyze the drawings and writings of 15-year-old Timothy Masters. Dr. Malloy concluded that some of these drawings depicted Timothy reliving the crime, and based his trial testimony on the drawings alone, having never once spoken with the boy. In 1999, the artwork was used to convince and sentence Timothy to life in prison. Timothy continued to protest his innocence, and even appealed on multiple different occasions, but the appeals kept failing. In 2008, his defense attorneys released evidence proving his innocence further. DNA tested showing the crime scene samples did not include Timothy's DNA, but pointed to Peggy's ex-boyfriend, Matt. While Timothy Masters was exonerated in 2011, it has not led to answers in Peggy Hetrick's case. One suspect in the murder was a man named Dr. Richard Hammond, an eye surgeon who was arrested in 1995 for filming women and girls in his bathroom. Hammond's house overlooked the dumping ground for Peggy's body, and he was at home the morning of the murder when he was scheduled in for surgery that day. Since his profession required so much skill, it was thought that he would have the right expertise to perform the sexual mutilations that were carried out on Peggy. However, in March of 1995, just days after his arrest, Hammond committed suicide. Jim Broderick ordered the evidence in Hammond's case to be destroyed before a link could be looked for and established between him and Peggy. Recent gazes have fallen upon the ex-boyfriend of Peggy, Matthew Zollner, when Timothy was exonerated due to DNA evidence that pointed towards Matt. He was originally considered a suspect in 1987, but quickly dismissed, although it is unclear why. An ex-boyfriend with an ever-changing story, and who only had an alibi until 3 a.m., seemed like a likely candidate for the murder of Peggy. And while it seems as though Matt is being reinvestigated, there are no new leads as of yet, leaving the gruesome case of Peggy Hetrick open and unsolved. Deborah Lindsley. Born in Bromley, in southeast London in 1962, 26-year-old Deborah Debbie Lindsley fell victim to a disturbing and heinous crime that shocked the nation in 1988. Working as a hotel manager in Edinburgh, Debbie returned to London to attend a hotel management course and stayed with her parents while she was there. She visited her brother, Gordon, as she was due to be a bridesmaid at his wedding in 2 weeks' time. On Wednesday, March 23rd, Gordon dropped his sister off at Petswood Station in the Bromley suburb of London, in which Debbie boarded the Orpington to London train. She chose a carriage that was isolated, and it is speculated that Debbie may have chosen it because smoking was allowed inside. It had no corridors that led to other carriages, and the only exits were at either side, leading onto the platform or the rails. This kind of carriage was being phased out in 1988, and Debbie's death caused British Rail to reduce the number being used during off-peak journeys, and they painted a red band along the isolated carriages so passengers would be able to identify them. Soon after leaving Brixton, a French au pair heard loud screams coming from a carriage, but later claimed she was glued to her seat and too scared to take action, with many criticizing her for not pulling the communication cord, which a passenger can pull to stop the train in an emergency. However, the au pair did see a red-haired man exit near Debbie's carriage, and she followed him across the station until she lost track of him. Other witnesses in the train station reported seeing several other different men, such as a scruffy man with dirty blonde hair, who left the train at Penge East, and a short, stocky man seen jumping from the train at Victoria. Out of around 70 people on board the train, the au pair is the only one to have relayed hearing anything specific, while some of the passengers reported hearing a commotion but did not investigate either. Online sleuths wonder if the carriages at either side of Debbie's were empty, which would give some reason as to why no one else heard her screams. By the time the train arrived at Victoria Station Platform 2, it was 12:50 p.m. As was common at the time, a British rail porter walked through the train to check for left luggage and found the floor and seat of the carriage Debbie was in to be covered in blood. He was then treated to the horrifying scene of Debbie's body. She had been stabbed 11 times to the neck, face, and abdomen, and one of these lacerations had caused her death. Debbie had defensive wounds on her hands, and while no sexual interference was found, police proposed the idea that she'd been fighting off a sexual attack. None of her belongings were missing, which made the police rule out the robbery theory. The fact that she had been murdered in broad daylight on public transport prompted authorities to wonder if perhaps this wasn't a first attack for the killer. No murder weapon was located, but it is believed to have been a 5 to 7.5 inch long, heavy blade, high quality kitchen knife. During the investigation of Debbie's murder in 1988, 1,200 witness statements were taken, and 650 individuals were questioned and ruled out. The case was featured on Crime Watch UK in April 1988, and it was also found that some of the killer's blood was mixed in with Debbie's, meaning that a DNA profile has now been built of the killer, who was likely injured in the struggle. To this day, almost 60 out of the 70 passengers have been eliminated from the investigation. Debbie's mother died in 2013, while her remaining family searched desperately for answers and for justice. So far, no matches to the killer's DNA have been found, and Debbie's tragic murder goes unsolved. And now you have the facts. Three horrifying, unsolved murders of the 1980s. Thank you for watching. Please subscribe and like the video to support the channel, and we'll see you next time.
Follow us on Twitter at Louie Gang Entertainment, on YouTube and Instagram at Louie Gang. It will mean so much to the whole team.